Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Master, Paramhansa Yogananda, Saints of all religions, dearest friend, Swami Kriyananda, we offer our lives in service and devotion at thy divine feet of unconditional love. We are your children. Bless us and guide us, that we may always be in perfect attunement with your will. Om. Peace. Amen. Actually, why don't we chant and then we'll meditate for just a few minutes. Well, great souls, there it is. And there's the back. So it's really beautifully done. It was designed by our Italian designer, Tejendra, who's just absolutely marvelous. He really poured his heart and soul into it. It's 635 pages of text, 40 pages of index, 70 pages of photographs, 32 pages of color photographs. And then on every single chapter, there's a photograph of Swami that relates exactly to the year. That ended up taking a lot more effort than you might think. So each year by year, as you go through the book, this is 1997, that actually is in the Palo Alto Church. That was one of our oratorios. You'll see a lot of your faces in there. Some of you'll see your faces. Yeah. And then, so you can go back and you can watch him. You can watch him age. Because here we are. This is 1971, when I first came to Ananda Village. Can you see that? Yeah. Standing in what was the dome at that time. So he goes year by year. We walk through it. So, and virtually every word that is written in any year chapter is the year that it was spoken, and all the pictures are from the time. And Krishna, Parvati, actually came up with a really fun idea, which Krishna's working on, which is she's going to make a audio companion series of year-by-year talks that relate to what's in the book. So that'll be fun. This is 72? It's 73, actually. This is after Swami went back to India. This is just a small thing, but you see that he's wearing this little crystal mala that Sai Baba actually manifested that for him. These are, when we were sleuthing down exactly what year was what picture, and many of them were, Lakshmi's been doing an incredible job, Lakshmi Selby at the village, of collecting photographs for the last number of years and dating them as best she could, because nobody thinks of history when they're in it, you know? So we would have to figure things like, well, that was the mala that Sai Baba made for him. And so it had to have been after he returned from India, and he went in November of 72. And I happen to know when this picture was taken, unlike some others. At one point, when we were all finished, I looked at the picture for, I think it was 91, maybe. And I realized that I think it must have been 93. The shirt he was wearing, he got in 1981. And it seemed very unlikely that he was still wearing it 12 years later. And there was a small thing in the background that showed that it was at the San Francisco Ashram House, which we gave up in 1989. So it could not have. So all of a sudden, when we were completely finished, and it actually took me about 4 days to find a picture that we could verify that was actually that year. I'm mailing them to all the people, and everybody has a weird story. Like, yeah, you know, like I remember that flower. I remember the moment that was it. I remember the shirt. I remember the haircut. I remember the girly thing that was showing, the teacup, you know, and everyone would try to guess. But I'm pretty confident that everything here is definitive. And in a lot of the color pictures, too, we did our best, the best we could. The color picture sections are by decades. And they're separated. I think there's four. Plus, before 1962, or before 1969, I'm not sure what we called it, but basically his childhood, his mother, and so on. And then after 2013, after he passed, we had a few, because we needed to show what Ananda has become, because we had a lot of history pictures. We didn't want people to expect to see the 100-year-old barn still sitting there. I just wanted to show you. We have this. You can't see it too big, but you can look at it later. This is my favorite picture of Swamiji and his mother. He was about 4 years old. I don't know how clearly you can see it. He was about four, and he's kind of leaning across his mother's lap. And it just is such a beautiful picture of who they were together. I absolutely love it. So recently, the treasures along the path, the recording they sent out was the astral ascension service Swamiji did for his mother at Ananda Village just after she died. She must have died about 81, 82, 82 or 83. So it was just really sweet to hear him talk about her. And this, for those of you who ordered or will order the, we have a $100 special numbered edition, which is really a transparent fundraising ploy. Sneha designed this beautiful book plate, which actually will go in, it'll go in this page like this, so that it'll have it here, with a number and a personal inscription from me. I've been writing them up. We've had about 85 orders, which is really helping. And then we have a little sticker that'll go on the front to say it's a special book. Otherwise, it's the same book. You know, Truth in Advertising, it's exactly the same book, but it'll have these little features. But it's very nice. I would never have designed it like this. I never thought to design it, but Sneha had the idea, and I think it's very nice. It's a picture you all have seen many times. This was Palo Alto also, but she just cropped it down to just Swami and me. So it's a big deal. It's like a super big deal for me, for the work. We'll see. Somebody already abbreviated it down to SKLB. Please don't. If you don't want to say it, say light bearer, okay? I'm serious about that. I can't bear it. Light bearer. Call it light bearer. That works. I have only three copies in the room right now. I got a small carton sent. A few more than that, sent airmail. It was printed in Hong Kong. I gave them out to a few people who were especially important in getting this book done, including Lakshman, and without whom I could never have done it. He is the world's best proofreader. There is a new verse in the Bhagavad Gita now that says, Krishna says, of proofreaders, I am Lakshman. Only in some editions is it there. And we're trying to figure out what the commentary will be on it. But I could not have done it without him, and of course without the designer. We'd hoped to have all of them by now, because just for pure sentiment, we're making May 19th the publication date, because here it is and we're holding it. And the books are actually on a boat from Hong Kong that James has been tracking, but he's not here right now to tell us where the boat is. And it'll land in Oakland, and they'll get it through customs. And the books are being stored at Ananda Village, so basically they'll be trucked to the village. We'll have a one-day notice. I'll buzz up there and fill my little car with as many books as I can carry and bring them back. So supposedly, or hopefully, we'll have them by the end of the month, if not right at the beginning of June. The 50th was the sort of final date, but we're making. If Lakshman hadn't been such a good proofreader, we might have had it available a little earlier. I got really crabby about it at a certain point, but Tejindra, the designer, who's much more experienced, and Lakshman, who are much more experienced, hosed me down and said, I said, we do not want to print a book with mistakes just to have it sooner. Yes, all right. I just thought it would be ready much sooner. And so I'd set all these arbitrary dates and was making myself crazy, which is sort of what we do in life. I think that's a summary of all of life, isn't it? We set arbitrary expectations, then we make ourselves crazy. I don't recommend it. I will hand this out. When I was thinking about this, I've been reading sections, and it's been coming up on Facebook, and I have two big satsangs that I've given, so it's not like I can say more. In about a minute, you're all going to be able to read the darn thing if you want to, so it'll be easier. Just give it to me for one more reason. You know, it's 220,000 words. So for people like me whose attention span is a little smaller, we divided it all up into little sections, so you never have to feel intimidated. You can take it in very small bites. Because the book is so heavy, as Karen said when she lifted it, we're going to sell a lot of e-books. Oh, that's what I wanted to say. We have the electronic version. We have an audio book that I recorded last fall, and Aryavan had edited it all, and it's ready. So the e-book, the print book, and the audio book will all be released at the same time. In fact, you can go if you go to ashajoy.org, it'll take you to a pre-order site. You can order all three versions now.
Will Amazon have it on Kindle?
And it'll be Amazon for Kindle. And I think on our site we have it for other formats, but it'll be Kindle on Amazon. Audible.com will have it. So it's, and because of Amazon's peculiar royalty system, where they want to keep ebooks at a low price, the ebook will only be $10. The book is $25 and the audio book will be $25, but the ebook is only $10. Just from our point of view, they give you like 70% royalty up to $20, up to $10, and 30% royalty after that up to $30 or something. So it was just pointless to make it more expensive. I mean, I didn't see any reason to help Amazon get richer. And I want people to read it. That's my intention. The Spanish translation is underway. The Italian is scheduled but not started. But those will take at least a year or two. You know, those are big projects. So that's the full story. And the presentation copies, the sale of those has really helped, because I think it's coming to about $60,000 to publish it, which is my father's good karma, because I still had money that he earned and left me, which I'd been saving for printing this book all this time. But nonetheless, I'm very happy to also have help doing that, because that's what the money was saved for, so I'm extremely happy to have spent it. But I realize that I may need to travel and may need to reprint and may need to do other things. Maybe some of my other books will sell. I look to the left and right, because the furniture in the house is made from the other books at this point. Because the other book about Swamiji is also just a treasure, and the book Loved and Protected, which is Stories of Miracles and Answered Prayers, is absolutely marvelous. Ask Asha is not bad. The other two are, I mean, it isn't, or else I wouldn't have printed it, but the other two are really superb. So I'm hoping that a little attention will get everywhere. And, you know, if there's a flow, the book has its own publication company, but it's a DBA of Palo Alto Church. So this is a way also to earn money for everything. You know, it'll give me the money to travel to promote it, and hopefully someday to reprint it, and if not, it'll just support the church, so it all works well. So what I was starting to say is, what I thought I would do is, I was just wanted to talk a little bit about why Swami matters, and, you know, why I spent all this time writing this book, why he wanted me to write it, and just that, because I think it's important. We had scheduled this to be 3 hours, because that's the normal length of a class, but I don't know if it will be. But I'll talk for a little bit and then open it up to questions or discussion, and we'll just go as long as we feel to go. Okay, does that work for everyone? Okay. Let me just try to think how this goes. On one of the excerpts that I read over the Facebook, I chose to read an excerpt that related to Swamiji's relationship to SRF, Self-Realization Fellowship. Those of you who are not new to Ananda, recognize, you know, that Master started his own organization, Self-Realization Fellowship, which is in Los Angeles. When Swamiji became a disciple in 1948, that's where he went, because that's what Master was. There was Master there, and then he had an organization that he'd founded, and he had an ashram, and that was what it was. There were disciples here and there doing other things, but that's really it. So Swamiji came there, lived as a monk, trained with Master. Before Swamiji was 26, Master had passed away. That's really hard to comprehend on a certain level, because all of us met him later than that. You know, the early of us who met him, he was at least 40 by then, and he was outside of SRF at that point. And he was so completely saturated with his relationship with Master that, and you knew that he'd been a direct disciple, that you just sort of, it was hard to put into your mind how short a time he'd had with him. He was older, he'd been a direct disciple, he was completely saturated with the discipleship. But then when you stop and think, 1948, September to March of 1952, and Swami turned 26 in May of that year. And that was it, 3.5 years. But it was enough to magnetize him for, you know, well into his 80s. He never wavered and never shifted in any of that. And the way to serve Master was through Master's organization. There was no thought in anyone's mind that you wouldn't. So when Master died, Swamiji just stayed there. There were all his guru bhais were there. Everybody he loved and had grown up with spiritually, or was growing up with spiritually, were there. And so he remained active and dedicated and became quite prominent. He was the main minister. He was in charge of the centers. He was one of the best known people because of his singing. They released a couple of albums of him chanting. So Brother Kriyananda, as he was known, was a really prominent figure. Master had intended for Swamiji, had made it clear to Swamiji that Master wanted to take him to India. And for 3 years in a row, Master said, we'll go to India this year. He wanted Swami to come with him. He wanted Swami to lecture around India and drum up interest in Master's teachings, and Master would follow after. They had a plan, so Swamiji had it in his mind. He was being told by his guru that India was his responsibility, his destiny. But each year, Master canceled it, the trip. And the last year, it was canceled because Master left his body. So among the things as a young disciple that Swamiji had to go through, but it was an assignment from Master. So in 1958, when Dayamata, who was the succeeding president directly after Master, went to India for the first time, she took her sister Anandamata with her. She took another nun. Anandamata was a sister in the organization, and Daya's blood sister also, biological sister. And then Sahajamata, who was another nun, and Swamiji. And she took Swamiji because everyone knew that Master had wanted Swamiji to go to India. And the plan was that the women would stay there for a year, and then they would leave Swamiji behind, and then he would... There was a small organization that was in place in India, Yogoda Satsanga, YSS. But Swami was going to really try to bring more energy to it because there wasn't that much happening. So by 1958, Swami tells us all this later, Mount Washington, which is the ashram, had already begun to change. Under the leadership of Dayamata and her sister Anandamata and Taramata, a group of women who were all direct disciples, most of whom had come as teenagers, all of whom had been with Master longer than Swami had, but they had a very different way of doing things, you know, and it was becoming very organized and very defined by rules and very nunish is actually the only word you can think of. And Swami was not like that. And his ideas were not well respected in the same way that the ideas of the rest of the board of directors were. He was a young man, and their point of view was, why doesn't he just wait to be told what to do? But he said, as he put it, he sat on a volcano of creative ideas, and he was just on fire to build Master's work. And it just was incompatible. Divine Mother sets these things up every once in a while. So he said by the time he went to India, he was happy to be going to India. He didn't really say that out loud, but he was happy to with the idea that he would have a field of his own to work in, or that he would be able to try out some of his ideas, which he thought were very good, but he never really got a chance. So he ends up in India, and then he's there for 4 years. During that time, Dr. Lewis dies, and that leaves a vacancy on the board of directors and a vacancy in the officers. So Swami is brought back to Los Angeles. He's put on the board of directors. He's the only man on the board of directors. And he's given Dr. Lewis's position as vice president of SRF. So he's, you know, he's a very prominent character. He stays about 4 or 5 months, 6 months in America, and then he goes back to India. But his ideas were too bold, and most of you know the story, but he felt that they needed to make a big statement in India if they were ever going to gain ground, that Master was simply not well known because he'd left and gone to America. Nobody knew him. So he conceived of the idea, this was 1960-61, when India was still very much run from New Delhi. India had only been a country for a dozen years. New Delhi was the capital, I mean, an independent country. New Delhi was the capital. Swami felt if we can be very influential in New Delhi, all of the country will know us and follow us. So he conceived of the idea of building a temple to Master in New Delhi, and he didn't want to build it. He wanted to build it, let me say this differently. Land use was very strictly controlled by the government. Manufacturing plants, colleges, everything had priority over ashrams. Ashrams we have aplenty. We're trying to develop a different reality. So they had this land, which was called the Green Belt, which was around the city of New Delhi, which was, you know, an ecologically sound idea in an urban area. And he had to get permission from the government to build an ashram in the Green Belt. And he said, if I have to get permission and it's impossible to get it, I'll just get what I really want. So he chose an ideal location right in the center of the city. And by a miracle, literally, he got Prime Minister Nehru himself to give him the land. And he already had the money to build a temple and was all set to do. But because it seemed so impossible, he wasn't reporting regularly back to Los Angeles because, as he said, he had nothing to report. Until Nehru said yes, there was the answer. There was nothing happening. And then Nehru very suddenly and unexpectedly said yes, and that was that. So he was triumphant. They were horrified. They thought it was anything but what it was. They thought it was a power play. They thought he was trying to take over the work. They thought he was trying to set himself up as a new guru. Weird misunderstandings happen even among disciples of the same master. These are just things that happen. So the end of it all is that Swami's expelled from Self-Realization Fellowship in July of 1962, ordered never to contact anybody else, never to set foot on SRF property, never to contact anybody in SRF ever again. So that's it. He ends up going back to his parents' house, who happened to live in Atherton, right here where we're right near Palo Alto, moving into their guest room. He's 36 years old. He has no connections with anyone in the world except the SRF devotees from whom he is forbidden to relate. His complete idea of serving Master is, how am I going to serve Master? I mean, this is Master's work. So as he said, he lay on his bed and prayed to die because he just didn't know what to do. Eventually, he gets drawn back, and that story he tells in The Path, it doesn't have to be told here. And so he eventually starts Ananda because he's very conscious of the fact he can't believe that he's going to be estranged from his fellow disciples for the rest of his life. It's just impossible for him to even imagine that. He also cannot imagine that Master's work will divide into two realities, you know, just 15 years after Master has passed in the first generation. He just, 25 years by now, he just can't imagine it. And he certainly doesn't want to be responsible for it. So he's always on the horns of a dilemma, because he doesn't want to be responsible for, you know, a great travesty against Master's work, but he also doesn't, he can't, as a disciple, not serve. I mean, and so this is the story of Swami's life. And as I, when I was saying in the short reading I gave, when I started this book, I really didn't know how much of this long story with Self-Realization Fellowship I want. I mean, I was hoping I wouldn't have to tell any of it, because it's not a pretty story. You know, you're talking about this wonderful master, and then you have to go through all of this. But I'm writing chronologically. In November of 1972, Swami's going back to India for the first time in 10 years. And the reason he hasn't been back in 10 years is because when he was expelled in 1962, the Indian government was told that Swamiji was, in fact, a Christian missionary and in disguise and an agent of the CIA. And so they would not issue him a visa. And even in 1972, they wouldn't give him a visa, but they were willing to allow him to come back for 30 days and plead his case. And at that point, he had a few high-level friends who said they would help him. And so he went back to plead his case. So I'm telling this chronological story, and he's going into 1972. The book starts really in 1971 when I moved. And in 1972, 1962 becomes an extremely relevant year. So the book goes, you know, 69, 70, 71, 62, 72, like this, because you can't go forward. Mm-hmm. Now, what this ends up being about, and, you know, this is from there on, it's a constant interweaving about, you know, what is the role of a disciple? What was Master's intention in his work? Who is really a true representative of Master? Is the tradition of institutional religion Master's ideal for Dwapara, or does he have another ideal? Now, people like me, who just, I had a very, very passing relationship with SRF, it kind of came and went. By the time, it was a rule in the early years of Ananda that everyone who lived in Ananda also had to be an SRF member, which meant you had to subscribe to the SRF lessons. The SRF lessons were quite inexpensive, like $2.50 a month or something like that, a very small sum of money. Since my whole salary was $50 a month, it was a higher proportion of my discretionary income, but nonetheless, it was pretty small. The lessons piled up on my desk, unopened, because they came every week, I think, and they just the pile of unopened envelopes got higher and higher, because every day I'm talking to Swami Kriyananda. By this time, I think I was probably working for him. I'm going to all his classes, which are numerous every week. He's giving every Sunday service. I don't really find these 3-page printed lessons very interesting. And I remember just sort of at one point realizing I could just stop taking them. You know, and it was sort of like this moment when I thought, I don't think I'm learning anything from here that I'm not learning from here. So I'm just going to save the $2.50 a month. That was my relationship with SRF. In fact, Swamiji said to me once, he was talking about the monastery at SRF, he said, I really don't think you would have been successful in the monastery at SRF. Then he said, come to think of it, I don't even think you would have been a very good church member. Because I have this habit. I have this habit of saying, why? That doesn't sound very good to me. Why? You know, I just am incapable of taking anybody's word for it. Anything that said to me, I have to trace it down to the bottom, then I have to build it back up. This is a very annoying habit, but this is what I am. I have to trace it down to the absolute bottom. I have to build it back up again, and I have to see if it has integrity for me. Swami himself said, as a disciple, he followed Master unhesitatingly, but not unquestioningly, which is an absolutely perfect, and that was always my relationship to Swami. I didn't hesitate in my commitment to him, but that didn't mean I didn't need to understand it on my own. Now, that is the model of Ananda. The model of Ananda is, it's not only that you're allowed to do that. It's that you really can't survive at Ananda if you can't really think for yourself. Because we just, the rules are just too hard to find. You know, they're just, it's just too hard to find who you're supposed to be. I mean, now that some of us wear blue, unfortunately, and I do say that unfortunately, there's a visual picture that people get that kind of defines people a little bit, which is the good news and the bad news. But otherwise, there's no, until the Nyaswami order came in, which was in 2009, and yes, there are people who stand up on Sundays and wear outfits. When we first started wearing ministers' robes, which was 1987, I think, and to hear it in Palo Alto, it took us about a year to get a robe that I felt I could wear. The first robes were made for pure economy, and the pattern was a costume for an angel costume, and the material was the cheapest cotton you could find because nobody had any money. I mean, this was like Swami wanted a white robe, so we made a white robe at the village. But when I moved to Palo Alto, which was at the same time that the robes started, I just couldn't see it. I couldn't see walking out onto the dais in this area in an angel costume made out of a sheet. I just really didn't think it was going to work. So it took about a year before I could find a pattern and a fabric that I thought I could use. And the first day we walked out in those robes, I remember saying, we were a little embarrassed, saying to the congregation, "This is a quiz. What is different about this Sunday?" But one of my favorite comments with that, Uma McFarland, who lives in Assisi now, but she's an early member of Ananda. She's from England, and she was living at the village or in Seattle or one of the places she lived. Her parents were very sweet, humble people, came over from England, and then they saw her doing Sunday service and so on like that in this white robe. And they went back home, and they had photographs. Her name was Annie. That's what they called her. They said, "See, when Annie's in her nightie, that's when she's working." But with the exception of those robes, which she put us into in 1987 and 2009 when some of us started taking initiations and wearing colors, you really couldn't tell who was who in Ananda at all. And that was actually a really wonderful part of it. You had to feel it from your heart. You had to find the people that inspired you. And that was that. There was no, the way, and it's still true that Ananda does not operate from position. Ananda operates from magnetism and the willingness to take responsibility. Period. Because position really doesn't get you anything with this group of people, believe me. You can't just get anybody to do anything just because you're supposed to be in charge. People find a way to sneak around you. Unless you have the magnetism to inspire, the enthusiasm and the energy. So, you know, inspiration, magnetism, and people who are willing to take responsibility. That's really how Ananda runs. Now, traditional institutional religion runs by position. The priest, the bishop, the pope, you know, who, the president, the vice president. I mean, that's really how it works. And the rules are pretty easy to find, especially the ones that have been around a long time, like the Catholics. You know, they've got it way down to just everything. How many times you can miss Mass before you go to wherever you go if you miss Mass or whatever. This is a Jewish girl talking. But, you know, the Jews have, I don't know how many thousands of laws. And the Jewish religion, I was in Israel, as you all know, a couple of times in the last 6 months. And, you know, the Orthodox Jews just gather every day and debate the law. You know, what exactly did God want us to do? And how can we pin it down? And what is it precisely? And so you have authority, and you trace that authority up, and you follow it. And that's how you can tell whether you're on the path or not. At Ananda, it's a little trickier. And it all began, it was all forced upon Master's work, and it was forced upon Swami by this very drastic action on the part of the board of directors of SRF, which absolutely severed his tie with everything but his guru. He didn't have a single disciple to help. And the excerpt that I read from the book was was Swami's answer to a letter someone wrote, because in the early years of Ananda, especially, Swamiji, this was very complicated because SRF wanted him to not talk about this because actually, well, they had lots of reasons. He said, I can't. People are attracted to Ananda. They want to move to Ananda. It's a huge commitment on their part. And Master's own organization says that's a bad idea. Kriyananda's not an authorized disciple. Swamiji said, I can't invite them to turn their lives upside down and move here. And then after they get here, whoops, guess what? Every other disciple of Master thinks you've made a terrible mistake. He said, they have to know what they're getting into. And he was absolutely right, of course. So some man who wanted to move to Ananda wrote to SRF and asked what he should do. And they said, essentially, that's a bad idea, because the sole authorized channel for the teachings of Master is Self-Realization Fellowship, and Kriyananda is not one of us. There it was. So Swami wrote back, and he, in this letter, which is in the book, he said, basically, you have no idea how hard I tried to stay with them, which he did in ways that you'll read. He said, but when I had no choice, I had to just go on my own. And he said, my life has required of me a kind of independence that I would never recommend to anyone, which was just a very honest way to say it. It's very dangerous. He said, I'm the first to say, it's very dangerous to be so much on your own and have no way of confirming or balancing your own intuition. He said, but I had no choice. So this is what I've had to do. And so he was he has always been very cautious. By the time he takes a stand, he's made up his mind. But he said often, he said anything I did at Ananda, I would meditate on. And he said sometimes for years before I would feel confident enough to say this is really what Master should do. So the fact of Swami Kriyananda's independent existence, and also what I was starting to say, many of us, back where I was when I was giving up the SRF lessons because I felt I was getting everything I needed from Swamiji, it's like SRF to me just never made any sense. I just thought, and I said it to him on more than one occasion, I was notorious for, you know, my t-shirt said, who needs them? You know, like this, what do we care? And it was not a very mature attitude, but maturity wasn't my strong suit, so there you have it. And I'm going to quote Sai Ganesh, and you'll have to forgive me, I hope you don't mind. He said, I'm always certain, but I'm not always right. And that's my new t-shirt. But I was always certain, and I wasn't always right. Because I couldn't see it. I couldn't see it beyond my own little life. You know, so it was self-evident to us who were there that Swamiji was everything we needed in order to be a disciple of Master. So what did it matter what these other people hundreds of miles away thought or felt? It just seemed so unimportant to me. And I remember finally, actually, we were driving in the car on the way to Nevada City. And once again, I said something to Swami about who needs them. And this time he finally got through to me. He said, Asha, it was 300 years before the Christian church split into the Protestants and the Catholics, he said, and look at the horrors that have been executed, that have happened in the world because of that. He said, Masters, this is the first generation of Master's work. He said, if it divides now, he said, who knows what terrible things will happen? He said, I'm not thinking of the present, I'm thinking of the ages. Oh, ah, there you have it, don't you? You know, it was very interesting, you see, he never stopped feeling responsible for SRF and the totality of Master's work. One of the reasons he struggled with it literally to the end of his life, virtually to the end of his life, was because he still felt responsible. You know, as a disciple, he just embraced Master's work, and he felt that their institutional approach to self-realization was not what Master intended. And he just felt it to the core of his bones. And that was, he had to be sincere in that, because that is what happens if individual disciples are empowered to represent the guru, then they have to represent the guru. You know, Swamiji would often talk about master's predictions of hard times to come. Most people did not enjoy hearing it. And sometimes they would say to me, people would say, why does Swami keep talking about that? I said, I don't know, that's a good question. Let's think about it. In 1952, Swamiji heard Master Thunder from the Hollywood Church, you don't know what a terrible cataclysm is coming. And he talked about war, and he talked about weeping in every home, and no corner of the earth will be safe. I mean, these are terrible things to hear. Nobody wants to hear it. But Swami's sitting there, and Master, his guru, whom we all revere as a self-realized master, is making this prediction. Is Swami just going to say, oh, well, that's unpleasant, I won't bring it up? If you're going to be a disciple and you're going to represent him, you have to represent him. You can't just sort of say that I don't like that one. Not unhesitatingly, not unquestioningly, but unhesitatingly. You have to at least try to figure out how I can support this. It took me years with Swamiji before I finally figured out how to do that, because I tended to react to what he said. And finally, I figured out, why don't you think about what he's trying to accomplish? And then think how you can cooperate with what he's trying to accomplish. Because sometimes he would be the first to admit his ideas weren't the best ideas. Someone on the scene who was closer to it had a better idea than he did, because they might know the circumstances that he didn't know. You know, even to be very expanded in your consciousness doesn't mean that you know the personality of or the exact circumstances. So he needed us. In Conversations with Yogananda, number 99 is the most interesting and odd of all of the quotations that Swami has from Master. And it's about whether or not Master needs Swami to tell him what's going on in the monastery. And Swami is a little confused, because aren't you omnipresent? Aren't you omniscient? And then Master talks about the problem of being omniscient and the many different levels that he has to live on, and how he does know and he doesn't know, and yet he needs things brought to his attention. I've read it multiple times, and it's just fascinating. So all of these dimensions, when a master incarnates, even a self-realized master, they live on all the different levels that we live on. It's amazing. So let me think where I was with that. Where was I going? Let me just try to remember for a minute. Oh, back, let's see. Well, I've sort of lost the thread for a minute, but I was talking about hard times and being a true disciple. So Swamiji set this course, and he's the most dynamic. He's not the only disciple who set an independent course, but he's far and away the most dynamic. Roy Davis also set his own course, but what Swami's impact is bigger. Just different. Their assignments were different, but Swami was on a very independent course, and was a lone voice compared to SRF for a certain whole interpretation of Master's teachings. Theology gets lost. Everybody just wants to be friends with SRF. Of course, why should we not be friends? We're guru bhais. We have more in common with each other than we do with anybody on the planet. So we don't have to be fighting with each other at all. But nonetheless, there are very important theological principles here that Swami personified. And he personified them with great force. And we would tend to think, many of us would tend to think, you know, it'll just work out. And this always, I love this, when I would think about this. And I thought about this a lot when I was writing the book, because it was so vivid to me. You know, I had to relive my whole life. Some of it was nice, and some of it was not nice. You know, I had a lot of realizations that I could have done a lot better. Maturity was not my strong suit, let's put it like that. Of course, one wants to feel that one could do better. Swamiji himself said when he went to India in 1958, from 58 to 62, he spent a great deal of time with Anandamoyi Ma. In the book that was just reissued, Visits to Saints of India, it begins with a little story about his time with Ma. But at the very end of it, he mentions, he said, this is just a little bit. He said, I was with Ma countless times, Anandamoyi Ma. And He said, very simply, he said, I had with her the kind of relationship I was not mature enough to have with Master. He said, I was just too young, and as he put it, too much in awe of Master to just relax and embrace in the way he wanted to. And naturally, one would like to feel every year when you turn around, oh, look, I've grown. If I could only have known this, then I would have behaved differently. So looking over, for me, 44 years, there were just countless times when I realized that I just completely missed the point, or and worse than that. So it was a expansive time on many levels, and not always. It was more easy than not. I don't want to exaggerate, but nonetheless, one has those experiences of, wow, I wished I'd known. I really would have behaved differently at that time. So Swamiji, you know, gradually began to feel, especially as the years went by, and the reconciliation he just thought was inevitable with SRF never happened. And Taramata, who was one of the main protagonists, died in 1972. And Swami just assumed, after she was off the planet, that, you know, now it will happen. But instead, SRF and Diamanta just hardened their position against him. Because, you see, he completely undermined the premise of SRF. The premise of SRF had become, this is Master's organization, it is the sole, these are their own actual words, the sole authorized channel for the dissemination of Paramahansa Yogananda's teaching. And the president of SRF is the authorized channel for the definition of what those teachings are. It's very clear, and it's very Catholic. We have the Pope, and then we have the bishops, and then SRF, we have the president, we have the board of directors, and we have the senior ministers. And just, you know, it's classic. There it is. And they're convinced. They're convinced that that's how it's supposed to be. But if they're the sole authorized channel, and there's this other disciple there who seems to be inspiring people, somehow he can't be. He just can't be, because it's theologically impossible. Because if he could, anyone could, and then what happens here? Catholic Church. You know, they burn the heretics at the stake. If you're not cooperating with us, you're not cooperating with God. Now, Swamiji had, you know, some really, really, really tough decisions to make. It's like, do I just let this stand? And we, all of us, well, not all of us, but me, I was just so like, I had this is where I was going. I had this, oh, it's all going to work out, you know. And then I would think to myself, so therefore, we don't have to do anything. It's just all going to work out. Everything's just going to be happy. It's all going to work out. We're going to win. You know, this was a battle that happened in the Catholic Church between the institutional church and the Gnostics. The Gnostics were the mystical branch. And I don't, you know, it was a pretty close parallel. And the Catholic Church was the institutional branch. And you don't hear much about Gnostics anymore, do you? Because they didn't win. The institution won and then gradually just wiped out the Gnostics. There was a huge branch of Christianity in India that was started by Thomas that was Sanatan Dharma. It was the same teaching that Jesus taught when he was 18 years in India. And then about 300 years later, the Portuguese Catholics came in. And they burned everything relating to Thomas's work. And so suddenly Thomas had just taught the Catholic Church. What do you know? I mean, these are all just the way it works. Swami had a much bigger sweep of history. And he also had a much greater respect for Maya and for Satan, because of his life experience, than I was mature enough to have. I just thought we could just knock Satan out with a little positive, sweet smile. Swami was not so sure. And he wrote that in A Place Called Ananda. At the end of it, there's something like called Karmic Trends or something like that. It's a very interesting chapter. And he just says quite simply, there's no certainty whatsoever. He said, and he talked about if Master was, he doesn't say it in that book, but if Master was Jesus, and look what happened to Jesus' church very quickly after he died, these are karmic trends that happen, and there's nothing to guarantee that the same thing won't happen again. We assume that we won't be absorbed by SRF and wiped off the map, but why would we be so confident? unless we commit ourselves to preventing that happening. And that's what Swami had to face. Do I commit myself to what I know Master intended, or do I just surrender? And he felt always that this was a battle happening on the causal plane. This was a battle of ideas. And that's why he wrote so many books. That's why he spoke with so much force. That's why he constantly presented these teachings in every context he could think of outside of an institutional religion. That's why he organized Ananda the way he did. That's why he worked with the leaders the way he did. Everything he did was because he was fighting this astral causal battle to ground Master's teachings in something that looked more like Dwapara Yuga and didn't just look backwards to Kali Yuga. And the SRF group never relented. Never relented, and so nor could he. And he needed to establish the principles. In 2010, he died in 2013. He wrote perhaps the most blistering description that he'd ever done so far in a book called Yoga, that ended up being called Yogananda for the World, explaining. And see, Swamiji never said, "I was with him, I should know," which is what this is how the SRF authority is established. We were with him, we should know. And then we were with those who were with him, so we should know. And then we were with those who were with him, who were with them. You know, it'll go on like that. Peter was the first pope, and it just goes straight down like that, skipping all the parts where there were three or four popes and, you know, things like that. It's just a straight line from Peter, because that's how you do it, if that's what you're going to do. So that's what they're doing. So Swami felt the principles. He always, what he did was he gave us his reasons. He showed us how he was thinking it out. And then he would make their cause as well as he could make it. Because he did not want us to just unquestioningly take his word for anything. He wanted to train us to be ourselves channels of Master. And none of us thought it mattered. He knew it really mattered. He knew it really mattered that this struggle is really just beginning. You know, it's not like it's over. It's really just beginning. And those of us who are committed to this style of Masters, being Master's disciples, need to be very clear-minded about what we're doing and why. And in the middle, I mean, you'll see this in the book. Swami was always conflicted about this, always conflicted. And it just went on and on and on. The book, Yogananda for the World, which he wrote at the end, it took him 2.5 years to get satisfied with that book. He said, "I wrote the Gita commentary in 2.5 months, he said, the whole commentary on the Gita. He said, it's taken me 2.5 years to get this book where I wanted it because it was too strong and people didn't like it, so he took it off the market for a while. He thought I shouldn't be even saying this at all. He had a dream about a saint who told him, don't be judgmental, so he took the book back. Then he wrote it again. Then he decided in 2.5 years until he finally felt, this is it, this is the book, it should be there, and it's there for the ages. Because there's a lot at stake here, and Swamiji is the one who stands for it. And of course, we're heirs to his tradition. And everybody has different ways of relating to the spiritual path. I was talking to someone who is what I call a 642. A 642 is the chapter in the Bhagavad Gita that says, if you strive for God realization but don't quite make it, you may be fortunate enough to be born to a family of yogis. And such births are very hard to come by. And that's verse 642 in the Gita. So in this very room, we have a 642. And, you know, in Ananda, we have quite a number of 642s now. But you didn't have to be born in Ananda, because if you were born into a family of enlightened yogis, then, you know, because people came from other traditions. One such who lives at Ananda asked me if he qualified, and I thought he certainly qualified. But when I was talking to someone about that reality, I said, well, you know, of course it's a great blessing to be born born at Ananda and grow up there. I said, but the problem is, you begin to think Ananda is what Ananda was to your parents. And your parents, of course, had their particular take on it. And so you might like or not like, in this case it was not like, what your parents' concept of Ananda, but you must realize that that's not necessarily what it is. It's just how they've picked it up. And so what's actually worked beautifully in our, you know, longer life as Ananda is that we now have enough different communities that people can grow up in one and then go live in another, go live in India, go live in Europe, and just completely break the upbringing tie to it and then make a decision. It's always been one of Swami's rules that no person, merely because they grow up in Ananda, is an automatic member. After the age of 18, they have to make a decision. It doesn't mean they can't stay necessarily. It becomes complicated. But they're not a part of it unless they choose it. You don't become a Catholic because you were baptized. You know, because here you are, just a squalling, naked infant. You know, what do you know about what you're doing? It's your karma to be baptized, but it's not necessarily your heart to have that. So in the midst of all of this, when all of this was going on, at one point, Swami had one of these horrible crises of conscience, and he called this was during the litigation, and Swami wrote this paper. The paper was called, "Has SRF Lost Its Way?" First it was called "Truth is Impersonal," but then it got to be "Has SRF Lost Its Way?" And it was a real expose. It was a pamphlet. And it was just a list of things that he felt they had done that just betrayed Master's vision. This would have been in the mid-90s, something like that. He just felt inspired to do it. Then he telephoned, I think he was in the house here, because it came out of some court thing. And then he telephoned all the colony leaders, and he wanted them to come to the Ananda Village right away to have this meeting. You know, are we going to do something aggressive? We'd only ever done things that were defensive, and now he wanted to know if we were going to do something aggressive. So for the next several months, one day we were going to publish it, the next day we weren't, then we were going to publish it, then the next day we weren't. I mean, it just went like this and like this and like this until he felt that we should do it, that we should actually just take a stand. Now, and somewhere in there, there was another meeting. I believe he called us all up there for that meeting also. And he basically said, let me just think how he put it. Is there any way we can be nicer? And we all spent a long time really trying to figure out if we could be nicer. And Swami said, truth is truth. I mean, at the end of it, he was really agonizing over this. He said, no. He said, truth is truth. We just have to tell the truth. So we went ahead and we did. Now, all of this, and I've been talking for a long time, and it's all about SRF, isn't it? Isn't that interesting? This was not my intention. But unfortunately, it's the point, which is that Swami has a unique mission and we're part of that mission. And everyone has a direct relationship with Master, and you know, and that's also part of what we're doing. Nobody's trying to take that away from you. But to understand what it means to be a disciple, we need a disciple in front of us to understand that. And even if we don't like a lot of what we see, I mean, much of what Swami said to me, I just didn't like it. He made a remark once, and I said, well, that's awfully cynical. He said, you'll see, just like that. And, you know, 10 years later, I thought, that wasn't cynical at all. It was just the truth. You know, he often was so strong that I wanted him to be wrong because it was hard for me to embrace something as strong as what he said. I really wanted him to be wrong. But in year by year, I haven't found that he was. So, as Ananda, now this is where I thought I would be much sooner than now. As Ananda, we are Master through Swamiji. We just really are. Because there are other disciples and there are other ways that Master has expressed. And so, if we are Master through Swamiji, it's very important for us to try to understand what that means. Otherwise, we won't have any power because that's the way this whole thing is manifested. When people would come here and Swamiji was already more distant from people's lives and they would say, well, I love Ananda and I love Master, but I just don't really tune into Swami. I would say, what you don't understand is you just don't know that everything that you're experiencing is Swami's consciousness. You just have some idea in your mind of who he is. You can't possibly love Ananda without being in tune with Swami because everything that we are is what he taught us to be. And now it seems to have this life of its own. Even just look at Jyotish and Devi. And they're so perfect in the position that they're in, and they're so perfect at their position. Swamiji said, you know, there has to be, this is one of the things he said. He said, SRF makes the president of SRF the sole definition of what it is to be a disciple of Master. This is what a disciple looks like. He said, at Ananda, he said, we have many, many examples. And one of the ways Ananda works is that you can find your inspiration and your guidance anywhere you want to find it. You know, we have many, many people who are leaders, who are experienced. It's just because you live in Palo Alto doesn't mean that one of our ministers has to be your primary guide. You can have a primary guide that lives in another place. You can be totally attached to Kirtani or to Gyandev or anybody, anywhere, to Haridas. It doesn't matter. It's magnetism. It's not position. It's magnetism, inspiration, and your relationship. Jyotish and Devi, exactly. He said, so we have many examples of what it means to be an Ananda disciple. He said, but if we leave it at that level, he said, very quickly, the image will become diffused and it won't be clear cut. So he said, we always have to have one worldwide spiritual director so that we can have it personified. And then from there, as he put it, from the one, it can spread out. But if there's no focal point for the energy, it will become diffused, and then there will just be competing images. And then he said that, you know, the person about whom I could say, you know, who perfectly exemplifies Ananda, without any persuasion on my part, he said, is simply Jyotish. And that was when he named him his successor. It was absolutely true, because it's magnetism. Everybody trusts him and knows him. And the two of them together just standing in this position, and we just take it for granted, you know, that there they are. But think about what their qualities are. They take themselves very lightly. They're completely selfless in the way that they serve. They don't hesitate to take responsibility. They're very humorous. You know, they're very humorous. They're very warm. They're completely natural in the way they relate. They don't insist on any accoutrements of authority. You know, they drive their own car. They just, now they actually drive a Tesla, but that was because someone just gave them a Tesla. And to be fair, Jyotish loves Dwapara Yuga things. I mean, he's having so much fun with that car. But anyway, but he drove it himself, or it drove itself, you know, it's sort of like. And you know, Devi is everybody's mother. I just, recently, somebody did something, and they did not put a picture of Jyotish and Devi on something that they thought later, oh, you know, it was really inappropriate. They're the leaders now. I should have put a picture. And the woman felt badly, and she went to Devi and said, I'm so sorry I left your picture off. Devi said, if I never see another picture of myself, she said, it will be too soon. But we take that for granted, don't we? Because that is us. You know, that's what we're like. These are the things that we're like. We don't have a lot of fanfare. We just are this way. Now, other people operate differently. We're not afraid of each other. We're all very approachable. No matter what people's position, we're just us. These are very important things, and these are all very specific things that Swami put forward for us. And the subtitle of this book is The Life and Legacy of a disciple of Paramahansa Yogananda. That word legacy, I mean, I spent endless time trying to figure out what the name of this book was, but that word legacy is the most important part. We are heirs to that legacy, and we have a serious responsibility to carry it out, because otherwise, how will it continue? And where will we get our power unless we attune ourselves really deeply to the legacy to which we are heirs? And it isn't, I don't think, sufficient to say we are disciples of Master. Because there are lots of disciples of Master, and many of them don't look anything like us. And they're not doing what we came here to do. They're not communities. They're not whatever they are. You know, they're just different. And that's fine. They can be whatever they want. It's not our place. I mean, the more the merrier. I'd like to see hundreds of Yogananda organizations, each one reflecting its own reality. And it's very fun. I have a friend in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and there's a very strong, it's actually an SRF group, But it was started by a direct disciple of Master. And it has a particular strength. He, you know, it's a particularly strong and dynamic group because it still has the reflection. Just some disciple met Master, and all the way in Brazil has just been doing... There's a couple of other South Americans who are direct disciples who just have done a whole work all on their own. The more the merrier. And they're different than us, as they should be. So that's why my book has 220,000 words in it. And every part of it, the point of it, you know, it's a good read. I don't think it's going to keep you up late at night turning the pages. It's not a novel. It's a serious read. And a lot of it is Swami's words. As it worked out, it ended up being a great deal of Swami's words, year by year in the chapters, not only the photographs, but the words, because Ananda developed. And at this point in time, there's quite a number of us who are more or less there from the beginning. You know, my membership number is like, well, the number I actually have is 13, but it's actually 15 because they made an error. They put Haridas and Nalini after me, and they actually should have been before me. But 15 meaning not the 15th person to come, but the 15th person to still be around. This was done at the 25th anniversary, I think, or something like that. It was a lot of fun to see how it came out. But there's still enough of us around to chronicle it. And that's my whole intention in writing this book, is that I wanted to preserve a direct experience of the legacy of Swamiji. And here's something really, really interesting that happened with the book. I used a lot of private sources because I saved. Swami told me I was going to write this book, as you all know, when I was 24. And so I got to worry about it every day. And I mean, it was really my nightmare that I would die without ever writing this book. I've explained all that to you. I don't have to go into that again. But I got to worry about it every day. But I also got to take notes for all those years. So I had lots of private notes, and Swami was... communicated a lot, you know, with mostly it's the people who ended up being colony leaders. It's a group of about 8 or 10 people, and he was very at ease with that group. That was the character. That was what would characterize that group. Somehow we were all very at ease with each other, so he could speak frankly without fear of being misunderstood. Swami was extremely conscious of his impact, and so if he knew that somebody, you know, he was just very careful. But when it was just any one of us, we were sort of interchangeable. We had different faces and different heads, but we were all interchangeable in that he could just speak very frankly. We were by no means the only one, but that was my little coterie is what I would call it. And there were phone calls, there were emails, there were conversations. But it was very interesting to me when I was going through all the materials, with very few exceptions, anything he said in private, he eventually said in public. Yeah, and I was actually quite surprised when I realized that. Usually by the time he said it in public, he had polished the language. He had the ideas really precise, and he was expressing them very carefully, whereas in a phone conversation, it would be just what occurred to him then. But he didn't keep anything secret. It was like he wanted everybody to know. There was no esoteric inner circle that had all these secrets that nobody had. You know, I didn't fully cognize that until I went through this whole book. If it was an important idea, he told everyone, with very few exceptions. Even very private things that he would share at the beginning as very private revelations, sooner or later, they were in a mailing to 10,000 people. Carefully expressed by that point, but usually pretty frankly expressed. And so that's all what's collected in this book. It's a history of... From it's this much of a history that's as wide as a football field. It's about 2 inches because it's just, you know, spirit is center everywhere. So it was from my little center as I looked out and what I saw. I sort of see it as a baseline. You know, we know that this picture was in 91 and this was in 92. And we know that the time that he spoke for Divine Mother at the Christmas meditation was not actually 1983 as the paper that it was printed on said, but was really, I can't even tell you what we went through. You know, Parvati was there, Bent wasn't. I mean, Parvati was there, I wasn't, so was there, this Anandi wasn't. Who was where, when, how could it have happened? It was just, It went on and on and on, but we're pretty sure that everything is exactly where it was. But now everybody else has to finish writing the story. I mean, those of you who didn't have as much experience with Swamiji, you need to understand what it is we're trying to do. And there are lots of initiatives that Swamiji never was able to fulfill. There were lots of suggestions that we were too dense to understand. There were lots of subtle things that nobody has ever understood yet. I mean, I don't mean the book has esoteric in it that you have to unravel, but just to even understand it. I had a fun example. I think I did tell you about the Swedish homes. Swamiji was always trying to get Ananda village to build so that it would look like the beautiful villages he'd seen in Europe. You know, this unified architecture, and he was never able to get the point across because most of us had never been to Europe at the time he was trying to get the point across, but he never gave up trying. And at one point he saw these prefab homes that were made in Sweden that he thought were charming, and in fact his house at Assisi is a, quote, Swedish home. That's what they began to be called. We called them the Swedish houses. And he really wanted us to import the Swedish houses and put them up at Ananda Village. And I sort of wrote about this in the book. And then when I was telling Dharmadas about it, who's the leader in Sacramento now, Dharmadas was a builder with Michael Gornick at that time. And Dharmadas said Swami gave them the responsibility of sorting out the problem of Swedish houses. And all Michael and Dharmadas, speaking for himself, all they could think about was they were builders. They had hammers, they had nails, they could make buildings. Why should they bring in buildings from Sweden? What is this craziness? There was no internet or anything like that at that time. So they end up on long-distance telephone calls with the makers of the Swedish houses in Sweden, wherever they were, with some English, but not a lot of English, builder to builder. Finally, they're trying to find out, you know, what are we importing? What are these made out of? So they hear the rustling through the English dictionary, and the Swedish guy says, they're made out of particle board. Michael and Dharmadas say, particle board? Particle board. And Michael and Dharmadas look at each other and said, we're not importing particle board from Sweden. No, it was just like, nothing. They would have nothing to do with it. Dharmadas says, 10 years later, he figured out what Swami was trying to do. You know, they were just building in the most conventional way. They weren't thinking. They were doing a good job, but nobody was thinking out of the box. Nobody was imagining what was possible. Nobody was picturing the whole reality. Nobody was really thinking in terms of who we wanted to be and what we wanted to be. Swami was just trying to break the mold, and all they could think about was particle board. So, you know, that's Dharmadas's moment of, oh, I wished I had been smarter at the time that he asked me. But what I wanted to do with this book is to just put enough things in there so that people can say, oh, that appeals to me. You know, attunement with nature, the superconscious living, the Akash course, the Living Wisdom School, the money magnetism, you know, dance, music, the peace treaty play. The building a retreat that looks like a Spanish mission, you know, just endless things. It just goes on and on. I just wanted to put enough of them in there. There was a point in Ananda's development when Swamiji really started expanding us. This would be like right after he published The Path. So 78, 79, after the fire. The fire came in 76, the book came out in 77. 78, he went across, back and forth across the country twice. And then he went to San Francisco. He was gone most of like 3 or 4 years, just outreach, trying to build. And then he came back and he sort of said, huff puff, I think that's enough. I think I'll stay home for a while. But he said, I never wanted to build an empire. He said, I only wanted to ensure that Ananda was broad enough that every devotee would have a meaningful way to serve. I mean, now, see, those are the absolute gem principles that we have to ask ourselves. What are we really trying to do here? You know, doing seva is central to spiritual development. So what is the responsibility? What is the goal of anyone in a position of responsibility? Well, we really want to make Ananda broad enough that everyone has a meaningful opportunity to serve.
We're not trying to build an empire. We're trying to allow, give souls an opportunity to grow. And you see, this comes back institutional versus what is the very definition? The definition of Ananda is the opportunity for souls to grow. So if we're not providing an opportunity for souls to grow, we're not Ananda anymore. And so writing this book, putting all as much as I tried to put into this book, which now Shivani is going to write the history of Europe, and I know Rambhakta has a whole book of stories that he's about to publish, and you know, there's just everybody needs to put everything they know onto the table so that Ananda will be broad enough that every devotee will have a meaningful way to serve. And will then be able to know how to think about what they're doing. Because, you know, Kali Yuga is very strong, Maya is very strong, and it's hard to get past particle board, you know. It's just like the mind just falls into its ruts, and that's not what's being asked of us. So, I think that's it. What I'd like to do right now is like take a few minutes break, because you all have been sitting here for about an hour and a half. And I don't have anything more direct to say, but I would be happy to take questions and continue for another half an hour or hour if you would like. This was set as a class time, as a 3-hour class, but I wasn't at all sure this was a 3-hour party. So, so actually, now I've sort of said what I have to say. So if there are questions or comments or discussion more that you'd like to have, I'd be really, really willing. Anything that anybody wants to say or ask? The question was, am I going to take this on the road? I developed such an affection for a reclusive life during the years that I've been working on this that I haven't found it easy to break that inner attitude. And in fact, I've been trying to think of just a way to go back into writing seclusion, but I don't think that's what I'm supposed to do. In 2012, Swamiji, it was in June of 2012, in the parking lot at Stanford, he suggested to me that he actually suggested that I should move away from here, because as long as I'm here, I'll get drawn into what's going on here. And he thought that I should make the whole world my community. The alternative to that was I have to live somewhere, you know, and I don't want to just live. I mean, I could just live out of a suitcase. So it was sort of, I don't think it was necessarily a literal suggestion, although it could have been, but it was that he said he wanted me to be a global ambassador. That was when he used that word. I should be Ananda's global ambassador and just not identify with any one place, but with Ananda's work everywhere. So I started a little bit of that at that point, and then I stopped to write this book. And during the process of writing this book, I discovered this incredible affection I have for the secluded writer's life, which I haven't really shaken off. So even though I've gotten invitations in America, and I have an open invitation in Europe, in several places, I've just said no. And I haven't really felt that was the right answer, but that was the answer I wanted to give, darn it, so that's the answer I gave. But then I got caught because I want to have an Indian edition of this book, and Sangeeta was very happy to publish it if I came. And so that I sort of like, I've been sitting back watching my life to see what it's supposed to be right now, because I'm quite in limbo, just tremendous in limbo. And so there it was. And then right at the same time, Jamal called me and asked if I would come to Singapore. He was trying to arrange a trip to Singapore, which was interesting because I was trying to get to Singapore just before I stopped traveling. That was sort of like, I was like, Singapore was a place I was trying to get to. We have a small group there. So one thing led to another. And so now I have a week in Singapore and 7 weeks in India from the end of July to the end of September. And I sort of feel that after that I'm not going to be able to say no. So it's sort of hard to see. I really don't. I don't know what to do. I just feel it's obvious what I should do, and I don't have any drive to do it, I guess is actually the word. So I'm really just trying to figure out what's supposed to happen. But how could I possibly write this book and then not follow it around? Of course I have to do it. I'm just being a spoiled brat. But I am. So there you have it. Part of what's happened is I don't know, again, whether I'm actually being divinely inspired or just lazy. I've sort of lost the DNA for that sort of thing. Not that I can't do it, but I can't arrange it. It's like I can't get my head around making plans. I can't even choose my own class topics. And either, you know, it's just another stage of life, or else I've just really got to take myself in hand and do it. So I would be very happy to do anything and everything, but I just can't quite see yet how I'm going to manifest it. So if anybody manifests it for me, I'll just do it in a heartbeat, because it's effortless for me to do that sort of thing. When I published the first book about Swami years ago, someone really wanted to help make it bigger, and they actually hired an agency, and I did a lot of things. And it seems like there was a couple of other phases where I was doing a lot of publicity. I'm very happy to do it, but I feel weirdly paralyzed about making it happen. So I'm just answering you honestly. But if anybody who hears this or sees this wants to help me, yes. Just tell me where to be and when to be there, and I'll be there. I think that's sort of what's trying to happen now. Okay? Fair enough. But yes, this book should get a very big audience. I don't know. I'm immensely curious. Anna Kirsch at Ananda Village, God bless her, with Tandava here, also have been getting it all set up on Amazon, getting the websites done. You know, so we have a good, strong web presence. Karen redid the whole, my personal website is called Asha Joy, and Karen redid it, so it's just absolutely gorgeous now. So, I really wanted all of this in place before the book came out. And there's a project also to get all my talks up as podcasts, because that's a whole huge other area that I've only just touched. So, I mean, all of it's in place. And we'll see. I'm very curious. This book will have a huge initial sale, and then will it just sort of whisper and become furniture in my house again? I don't know. I hope not. I'm quite willing to promote it, but I'm a little paralyzed somehow about knowing how or what to do next. Probably the whole world has changed. I used to know how to do it in a very different way, you know. So we'll see. Volunteers are welcome. And I don't think, things don't have to be systematic. Sometimes people think you have to do everything systematically. I don't. I think you can just do them when you do them. You know, every little bit helps. We don't have to have a global campaign. We can just dart out here and there and see what happens. When the Italian book comes out, I'll definitely have to go to Italy, but that's not going to be for probably at least a year. I don't know how long it'll take.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the naming of the book?
The name of the book was such a... First I just called it Swami Kriyananda, Disciple of Paramhansa Yogananda. That seemed pretty clear to me. I was told it was a teeny-weeny bit passive. So then I called it Swami Kriyananda, Disciple of Paramhansa Yogananda, Dare to be Different, Dare to be Free, which I thought was just absolutely fabulous. The designer pointed out that it was about 100,000 words and he didn't really want it on the cover. So he and I struggled with that for a while. Then he made Swami Kriyananda, Disciple, just like that. That looked really good. He gave me a mock-up. Tejindra's technique is to give you a really good design for the one he wants. It works very well. So that was a really great one. So that went on for a while. And in the meantime, I'm just passing these out to everybody. And at some point in there, I called Robert Zadig, who's extremely clever with these things. And this was like early on. And I said, why don't you help me come up with a title? So he sent me all these different titles. And then I think it was Swami Kriyananda, Disciple, which I was sort of kind of settling in on that because all of us as disciples thought that was terrific. And I think it was that was the one. It might have been Dare to be Different, Dare to be Free, that Robert Zadig thought was god-awful. He just thought it was terrible for a whole lot of reasons. He had a whole lot of reasons why it wasn't good. I need to be fair to him because I'm not quite sure which one he thought was terrible, but he really did not like what I was doing at all. And I respect him a lot, so I was a little stranded. And everybody had an opinion. I don't usually, I'm usually not that interested in what people think. But in, for some reason, in this case, I was just asking the planet. You know, I was mailing these all these different these titles out, and people like this one, people don't like that one. And then he reminded me that he had suggested Swami Kriyananda Lightbearer, which somehow I'd never seen before. And all of a sudden, I really liked that one. So I passed it out, and it either got a 10 or a minus 25. I mean, a lot of people thought it was really terrible. It got really, really bad reviews. And I'm just like, I don't know what to do. And then I just woke up in the morning, and the book said, "My name is Swami Kriyananda Lightbearer." And I said, "Okay." And then I told people that was the name, and I got a lot of responses back, and I said, "Too bad, out of our hands." Because it really was. It was just, this is the name of this book. So I don't know how these things work. It's just so mysterious. So, I mean, and let's call it Lightbearer. Let's not call it SKLB ever. Yes. Well, he didn't want a disharmonious split, but yes, a split, but go ahead. Uh-huh.
So was that simply because he was afraid the message would be delivered differently, or were there other reasons?
No, it was the antagonism that he was concerned about. He was competing theological absolutes. You know, this is what Jesus meant. No, this is what Jesus meant. Well, if you think that's what Jesus said, then you're a heretic and I'm going to try to kill you. And if you try to kill me, then I'll try to kill you because I know what Jesus wants and you didn't know what Jesus wants. I mean, think about it. The Protestants and the Catholics in Ireland, you know, the Gnostics and the institution. Just as, I mean, declaring people heretics and killing them is, that's what religion is full of. Everybody has the absolute word of God. It's okay for people to have different points of view. Swamiji wanted to influence SRF in a certain direction that he thought was more in tune. But he also did not want to be expunged. So when SRF sued us and really tried to expunge us, to take away our right to be disciples, that's what that lawsuit was about, he said, there's absolutely no way. We will die first. We will not allow anyone to tell us that what it is to be a disciple. That's for us to decide. It's an extremely important principle to him that we all had to stand behind and gradually learn. Because, you know, before 1990, when SRF sued us, we were just, you know, we were just so childlike in our happiness. Nothing, we were just having this really good time. But there's the innocence of immaturity, and then there's the innocence that is a deliberate act of wisdom. And our innocence was very much on the basis of, well, we're so nice, nothing bad will ever happen to us. It was sort of the, of course, this attitude of discipleship will triumph and will never be wiped out and it won't matter. But that's naive. That was what Swami would say things to me because he had a view of life. I mean, there he was. He had these people who had become his, you know, determined on his destruction, were the people he had been the closest to in his life and had respected the most. I mean, like, Maya is awful. It's just really awful. But he knew it. He knew that that was what the world was like, and we didn't. And when we got into that litigation, which went on for 12 years and got really, really, really ugly before it was over, we realized what the world was like. And we realized that you just can't have a spiritual path that's based on everybody being nice. And it was a big test for Ananda, too, because people just wanted to be nice, and they wanted it to go away, and they didn't want to have to die for what they believed. And sometimes you have to be willing to. You don't necessarily have to, but you have to be willing to. You have to just draw a line in the sand and say, no, you can't do that. It's not right. And so now, what exactly your question was, as I have lost, was why he was so determined on it? Re-articulate it. Did I answer it?
No, I was more wondering why he didn't want it to split into several things, which you would think, in a way, would expand the world.
Well, he didn't object to it splitting into several parts, but he objected to it being a schism, or whatever that word is, where there's really like this, our way is right, your way is wrong. That was what concerned him, not a whole series of independent. I asked him a similar question. I mean, like, Roy Eugene Davis was doing his thing, and You know, there's disciples of Lahiri and there's disciples of Sri Keshwar. I mean, there's just disciples all over the place. Just the opposite. Every disciple should do what he's supposed to do. In India, the tradition is when the guru dies, every disciple just goes out and does his own thing. They don't even try to hold it together. Every disciple has a responsibility to carry on the guru's work. And Swami said no one disciple could ever encompass master's work. It's just impossible because one disciple isn't big enough to encompass it. It takes all the disciples to encompass it. But SRF trying to declare itself the sole authorized channel and therefore everybody's a heretic, that was heartbreaking to him. Just heartbreaking. He just wanted harmony, respect. He said, even we can disagree. In one meeting with Dayamata, afterwards he came back and he said, you know, we disagree on really fundamental things. He said, she raised a point, he said, that churches have fought for hundreds of years over. He said, but I thought to myself, why? We don't have to. We can just love each other and just disagree. And so that's sort of where he wanted it to be. Does that more of an answer? But it's this huge, broad sweep of history that I just don't have. He was so highly educated in both secular and religious history and had been a king in previous incarnations. You know, he just instinctively knew all these things. And he said he had a gift. He could always tell when something started how it would end, meaning that he could often sense something that was going to be an aberration long before anybody else knew it was an aberration. So he would correct a course because he knew inevitably where it would go and it would need to be stopped. And that's what he saw in this, the potential for it to go someplace that nobody would want it to be, which it did through all that litigation. But the end of the litigation was actually ironic because SRF was the unquestioned owner of all things Yogananda. And whenever anybody violated their ownership, you would hear about it from a lawyer. And nobody had the nerve to stand up to that. They just couldn't. And so they went into this with the belief that they owned all this stuff. Actually, not quite. They actually knew that they didn't. But they acted as if they owned it. And somewhere in the middle of the lawsuit, John Parsons, our lawyer, had an inspiration that he said himself that Yogananda put into his mind. He was just sitting there one day, and the thought came into his mind, and he sure master said it, challenge the validity of their copyrights. And so we sent Latika and Nidruva to Washington, D.C., who went into the copyright office, and we saw that master had never transferred the copyrights to his writings to SRF. He copyrighted in his own name, and when the term was up, they simply registered it as SRF, but it was never copyrighted, never transferred. And so that was the whole case. That's why we have all of these writings of Yogananda that we can all publish now. The same thing happened with the photographs. The recordings were not quite litigated down. The SRF, we conceded the recordings, basically, because they have physical possession of all of them. But the photographs and the writings are public domain. So they started as the undisputed owners, and they ended with it all being in the public domain. It was just the most ironic boomerang of karma. Because if they had not sued us, we would never have figured that out. They would have just asserted it, and everybody would have accepted it. Isn't that funny? So you really see Master has his hand in things. The question is, ananda.org has this subscription service that's called On This Day in History, and it tells you what Yogananda was doing on this day. And some of them are just fascinating. Yogananda's talking to the Women's Business Organization in Duluth, Minnesota, about, you know, finding your ideal mate, or in this case, you raised the question, Indian business methods, yeah. You know, healing. There's just, my favorite of all of them is superconscious healing methods administered by the Swamiji, bring your sick friends. But most of that information was collected by John Parsons, because the book he wrote, Fight for Religious Freedom, has a very interesting very interesting structure where he goes through the 12 years of litigation that we went through, and then he inserts parallel experiences of Master. And in the course of doing that, because John is a researcher and a lawyer and this sort of thing, he just accumulated a lot of day-by-day events. You know, when there is a source for it, like this became a chapter in one of the books of speeches, I think it's referenced. Otherwise, I think it's lost. I mean, people didn't record like they record now. SRF has many, many recordings, but I don't think anybody was following him all around the country in the 1920s and 1930s. So probably not is the answer.
I'll go back to Parsons book and see.
Yeah. And Diamata, when she was present, took notes. And I think those notes are what made a lot of the books. But I don't know. There's other notes. There's, you know, things circulate, but not Indian business methods delivered at so-and-so. Wouldn't that be fun? Tom, who's a writer and a columnist for the New York Times, he wrote a story about this small town in Minnesota. Maybe some of you have seen it. I can't remember. It has a name like Waka or Wicca or something like that. And it has turned out to be a magnet for Somali immigrants. And in fact, Karen was telling me that her Uber driver was from Somali, and there was just conversation about it. It's like the word is around in the Somali immigrant community that there are jobs and they will be welcomed in Minnesota. Scandinavians are more open-minded. There's a whole, I don't know what the reasons are. So there are a lot of jobs. There's a meat packing plant and various things, so people can go just right to that place. So from being completely white, and here's another part I liked. Tom Funder knows about this town because his aunt and uncle lived there. And he said, until the last 10 years, when all the Spanish-speaking people and the Somalis have come in, he said his Jewish aunt and uncle were the most exotic residents in the whole town, the only two Jews in the town, and they were called the Frozen Chosen. But then he just talks about the fact that this very, very white town, I don't have, it's a small number of people, 50,000 or something like that. It's now half non-English born, not English as a first language. There's 12 languages in the elementary school. I mean, just look at that, what a revolution. What a Dwapara Yuga thing. So, of course, the fact that all those Latin Americans and Somalis have had to flee their own countries, and everybody, rightly, is just totally freaked out by the chaos of the planet. But the result, look at what an interesting result it is. Actually, I'm looking at Anakaiza here, because Anakaiza and Katarina were both at our Sunday service, and they're both from Finland, and I didn't know either of them well, and I had a little trouble telling them apart. You know, delicately built, beautiful women with long blonde hair. And I remember asking you, or both of you, does everyone in your country look like you? And you more or less said, yes, we all do. Now I read, you know, that Scandinavia is being Syrians and Somalis. And you know, at first the cultures will stay separate. Then the kids are going to go to school together. Then they're going to fall in love with each other. And pretty soon not everyone in Finland will look the same anymore. And it's all because of chaos and sometimes because of horror. But the divine hand, divine is playing a very different game than the game that we're playing. And, you know, such things would never happen except for all this confusion. You know, that it's, Swami says, and it's when it's the Treasures Talk for this month also, or last month, Visions of the Future. And he says, all this energy is coming into the planet, and people don't know what to do with it. So they're using it in desperate materialistic ways. They're using it in incredibly sensual ways. They just don't know what to do with it because there's just so much more energy. I mean, people just used to live on the farm, and you know, they had their Sunday shirt and they had their work shirt. They didn't have 1,500 shirts in the closet, and you know, just the way we live now, because we have so much energy, we don't know what to do with it. So we just go buy shoes, you know, we just don't know what to do with it. But he says, you know, many, not only Master, but many great teachers are being born into the world, will be born into the world, to tell us what to do with that energy. Mm-hmm. And so right now it's also being used in violence and self-aggrandizement and stunning greed and all these ways. And it's not an easy transition, but it's just Swami being so impersonal the way he was looking at it. It's just that's we just don't know what to do with the energy, so we're making a mess of it, humanity. But we will. We'll figure it out. And all of this war and poverty-caused migration is really the only word for it. It's really, and you can see why people are panicking. I mean, I don't know if I'm even accurate about Finland, but think if you know, if you're a fifth or sixth generation person in Finland and suddenly there's a very dark brown person, you know, speaking your or not speaking your language, just, you know, holding the hand of your little six-year-old child, it could freak you out. What's happened? What about my world? And we don't know what to do with the energy. So sometimes we try to suppress it. No, I'm as nervous as the next guy, but when you can stand back a little bit, but it's hard to, but when you can, you see it very differently. I mean, that's why Swami was born. I'll bring it back to our subject. That's why he was born. See, he has created an entire alternative civilization. Really. And I wrote in the introduction to the book, right now, nobody cares. You know, nobody really cares. Just a tiny, tiny number of us care. But when the inevitable collapse happens, whether it happens in an individual life or society as a whole, and people are really become interested in, you know, what to do, I think they'll be surprised when they look around and realize, oh, look, there it is. That's what to do. That's how to be an artist. That's how to make money. That's how to have a community. That's how to raise your children. That's how to educate your children. You know, that's how to have fun. You know, it's just, it's all there. The entire, it's a whole civilization that he built. And this is, again, going back to the other theme, you know, SRF has done a great job. They have a monastery. They built a wonderful monastery, and they have householders that circulate around it. But they haven't created a new form of music, you know. They haven't been writing plays. They haven't written a material success course. You know, they're doing what they're doing really well, but they just haven't done what... They haven't given people a whole way of life. And Swami sees that's what Master came to do, is a whole way of life, not just another version of the same tradition. That's why he was so avid about it. This is not another version of the same tradition. This is a new dispensation, a new expression. Well, that's a good question. The question is, how has this whole process of writing the book, I presume you mean, it impacted my relationship with Swami? Made me wish he was still here. But that's not hard to do. When I was in seclusion writing, I was more in tune with Swami than I ever was before or ever have been since I had to come out of seclusion, which gave me a watermark for the possible. You know, I've always felt that my random ideas come from him, especially when we first started the work here back in 1987 and just went like a house of fire for years. And I remember thinking in 87 and through the 90s, I always knew what to do. I just always knew what to do. And I thought it was because I was well trained. It was only later that I realized it was because he was guiding me that what I thought to do was what he was telling me to do. But when I was in seclusion writing, I mean, he was talking in my head. You know, it was the kind of thing, not on the level that Swami talked about when he was writing like Essence of Self-Realization, where Swamiji said basically he sat on the couch with a pencil and Master dictated to him. He had notes, but he didn't have enough notes and he needed more. When he would need more on another subject, he said he would hear Master's voice in his head. And he said so clearly that sometimes he would have to say, could you repeat that again? Or could you slow down? You know? So I certainly wasn't operating on that level, but I was very conscious that there was a presence that whenever I had a question, it would tell me what to do, or that I would try to include something and it just wouldn't go in, and then I would hear Swami tell me it just didn't belong, or I would write something that I thought was good. I mean, I've told you some of this, that I thought was good, and then he would just hassle me. I had this one sentence in there that was the typical sort of vague thing that people write, where it kind of sounded like it might mean something. I used the phrase the compass of devotion, which I thought was kind of cool. And I had a kind of a phrase there. But, you know, when you stop and think about what is the compass of devotion, what the heck does that mean? Devotion is my pole star. The power of devotion guides me. But the compass of devotion, no, it almost means something, but in fact it means nothing. So I had a whole sentence built around it. And really, for days, he kept telling me, Asha, that doesn't make any sense. Get rid of it. And I would argue that it almost makes sense and it sounds nice, doesn't it? And he would say, get rid of it. Until literally, we, that's the only way I can put it, we just started laughing. And I said, all right, I'll take it out. And there was another one too where it was just a sentence I couldn't understand what he meant. He said that he didn't want, in future people will try to make the songs more artistic. That's not the way we want it to go. And I knew it was important. And then, I mean, but for, I just stuck it, I put it in, and in one chapter, and then it came out, and another chapter, it came out. It just it went on and on. Finally, he said to me, artistically complex. I said, of course that's what he meant, artistically complex, because that's not the way to go. But of course you want to make them more artistic, but for some reason I hadn't written out the whole phrase. So he told me, oh yes, that's what you mean. Because sometimes, you know, you just didn't, either he didn't say it, because when I was with Swami, we would say a lot with very few words. I mean, sometimes we had long conversations, but I could get a whole life direction with just a sentence or two. You know, when I was talking about global ambassador and trying to decide what to do, and my presence in India was slightly confusing because there were so many other people in India. So I said, when you said global, did you mean India? He said, no, I meant global. I said, when you said global, did you mean the USA? He said, I'm of two minds about the USA, he said. And I said, me too. And then he said, go where there's energy. But, I mean, that's all he had to say, but there was a world of conversation in all of that. So a lot of times there weren't as many words as there was meaning behind words, because that was just the way he was. At the end of his life, it was sort of a joke. He called everyone Leela at the end of his life. I mean, he called Narayani Narayani, but before Narayani was there, he just started calling everyone Leela, and it was kind of like an intuitive issue. You had to decide which one who wasn't Leela was the one he really was intending. There was something, you know, sometimes he would even say it, you'd sort of start to ask him, he says, oh, just use your intuition, meaning don't make me explain it, just tune in, you know, what I want for lunch or what might happen. Or so the end of all of that is, the first and best thing that happened from writing this book is that I feel, the way I put it, which is not a very nice image, but if I get cancer now, I don't have to take chemo. Like, I can stop breathing now, and I'm fine. If I had stopped breathing before this book, if I had gotten cancer before this book, I would have had to follow every heroic measure there was to keep living till I could finish it. I genuinely and totally feel that everything I do now is extra. And I hope to do more, but I don't have to. He can take me off the planet now, and I'm done. And I, after living afraid my whole life that I would never reach this point, you know, that's relaxation on a level that is just incredible. My psyche has always been tremendously talented, but never accomplishes much. And what if it really ends in disaster? You know, that's been the little, like, it didn't end well. That would be like my gravestone nightmare. Now it says, she did it. Yeah. Well, Swamiji always wanted me to write. He actually, in my 20s, tried to just get me. In my 20s, he tried to get me into the writer's life. But I was phobic about writing. I had a very neurotic relationship with writing, really neurotic. And he finally gave up and said, well, you're good at speaking, let's do that. He said, and his exact words were, it'll give you the confidence to write, which seems weird that this whole life has just been to give me the confidence to write. But I didn't have a complex about speaking, and I had a complex about writing, and so the karma to overcome that complex has been really important for me. So just in terms of one trajectory, not that this other side has been useless by any means, but It has had a different purpose than writing has had for me personally. So there's always in the back of my mind that, maybe I could just stop talking. Because I do like to communicate when I finally got. And as I've said to you all, I like my own ideas best. And so when you're just by yourself writing, if you don't give the manuscript to anyone, you can just do it your own way. And that was very, very satisfying for me. And Swami had actually told me, because at different points I said, do I really have to do this? He said, you won't be satisfied unless you do. I mean, he always knew me better than I knew myself. So I understand now that I realize that I can have solitude and communicate both. That's what I mean by the writer's life. I suddenly got what the writer's life is, where you can be an introvert and an extrovert somehow at the same time. And that works for me. If I ever get out of limbo, which is the way I feel I am right now, I mean, they're such obvious. You're in seclusion and write for half a year and you travel for half a year. I mean, it's like, if I weren't feeling like such an airhead, it would be pretty easy to organize. It's just at the moment, I can't ground anything. And history tells me, my life history tells me that don't push it, it'll work itself out. That, see, the thing is, this book did not come out the way I expected it. This book is so much Swami's words, and it's not the breezy memoir that I thought it was going to be. It's not the rambling reflection on all these different things that I tend to weave together. All of that is in these wonderful articles that Rambhakta has been editing from my talks. But I feel that I need to go through them before we put them out as a book. So that's basically, if I can get that book done, which is really, Rambhakta's done 9/10 of the work, but with all due respect, occasionally he took liberties or misunderstood something, or I feel like it could be clearer. I don't feel, they're all on a blog and they're really, I mean, let me phrase it differently. I get a lot of really positive feedback, really a lot of positive feedback from them. And I think they would be really good in a book, but I have to go through them before I can feel confident to do that. If I can publish that book, then I would feel like I've pretty much said everything I have to say. So I might take chemo. We'll see. I would really like to. I thought maybe I'd just go away into seclusion and just do that one right away. But I don't think so. You know, I have India and then I have Israel in January, so it's a lot. And I don't know if I can abandon the school play yet. So we'll see. Well, if there's nothing else, I won't keep you all. Thank you all very much for coming and sharing this very, very happy birthday weekend. Tomorrow is Swamiji's birthday, and our Sunday service will be dedicated to him, and we'll have the 3 copies of the book on the altar, and we'll have some kind of an official world here it comes and little blessing ceremony, really mainly because, you know, this book has the potential to bring a lot of people to our ray, or to make people deeper in our ray. So it's our project that we all need to bless with our love for our yet unmet guru bhais, basically, our soon to be met brothers and sisters. You know, we have a big family. All right, thank you very much. Okay.